more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. When you're a kid, a lot of the world seems like a mystery in need of figuring out. And probably the most obvious example of that is figuring out your own parents. That's what Miles Adler Hart sets out to do from a pretty young age. He's the fictional hero of Green Bay native Mona Simpson's latest novel, Casebook. Miles goes so far as to employ investigative techniques to snoop on his mother as she and his father divorce, and she starts dating the mysterious Eli. Over the years the book covers, Miles not only learns about the inner workings of adulthood, he begins to understand more about himself. Mona Simpson, whose other books include the well-regarded Anywhere But Here and Off Keck Road, was back in Wisconsin recently, and she stopped by our Studio B. Thanks so much for being here. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Do you think mother-son relationships are explored enough in literature?
That's a good question. I suppose I can think of some if I really put my mind to it. It's funny. It's something I haven't actually thought about. I'm thinking, when you first say that, I'm thinking of this great scene, I guess, in War and Peace, where the mother of the hero is quite desperate to get the money for his education. I think she's a poor widow, and she goes to ask her wealthy friend to borrow money for his education. And that's one. Of course, that's a grown son and
sure.
a grown mother. But I guess you're probably asking that since I've written a book about a mother and a son.
Well, yeah, exactly. And as I thought about many of the books that I've read, certainly in recent years, there's a lot of mother-daughter relationships that are portrayed. But it's rare to consider how a mother and son affect each other.
I think that's true. Now that I think of it, I hadn't actually thought of that before. But I think it's interesting to write about kind of the way we live now with the family. So in this case, it's a divorced mom and a son who has little sisters, so he's sort of the man of the family, which I think is a kind of a new iteration a little bit and has its own complexity.
Well, and you say it's the something to the way we live now, and I got to thinking this is set in Southern California, and I wonder if there's something – you know, you grew up in Wisconsin, but you now live in California. It's hard for me to imagine this book being set in Wisconsin. Is this a California novel?
I don't think so. I think this book could be set in Wisconsin. I mean, the sort of central themes of sort of spying on one's parents and wanting to protect one's parent and not being able to, especially in a case of divorce, that happens here too.
Well, certainly, yeah. And maybe it's just there's certain specifics to the setting that feel
right.
very California.
Yes,
certainly they feel foreign to Wisconsin.
Yes, it's definitely set in L.A.
The issue that comes up repeatedly in conversations between Miles, who's your protagonist, and his best friend Hector, who's kind of a secondary protagonist, if you will, is this idea of whether they are happier with their parents apart. And that's a question that I remember asking myself a lot when my parents divorced. Is that a question you've turned over in your head a good deal?
You know, it's funny. It's a funny thing about writing books, but you find yourself learning – probably so, but I wouldn't have actually said that if you'd asked me that 5 years ago before I wrote this book. And yet I grew up with divorced parents, and I probably did have exactly that thought. Although in my case, I don't really remember my parents together. They divorced when I was quite young. But I think it is a sort of question, and I think it's also, in a funny way, I think it's a typical question of divorced children, because one of the things about divorce, if you're the child, is how little power you have in it. And it's a way of trying to think whether or not you would rather they'd be back together or not is a way of almost assuming that you do have some control in a situation where really you don't.
Well, and it strikes me that Miles, who's kind of – he's narrating this in retrospect, but he's really growing up as the novel progresses.
Right.
And he seems like he's kind of coming to terms with understanding his own power.
Right. And how much of it he has and how much of it he doesn't have.
There's a lot made of the phenomenon of the unreliable narrator in fiction. But I was thinking about Miles as the narrator, and I wonder if he could be anything but unreliable in a way, because he's sort of in this position where he doesn't have a lot of power and he only has access to a certain part of really what's his own story.
Right. I think that's certainly true. Although he's trying to be reliable, which makes a difference. you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And it strikes me one of the real – what you've really managed to pull off in this book is that as he gets older, he gets somewhat more reliable.
Yeah.
As though his memory – you know, it's not that it failed him, but he only understood a certain number of things
right.
when he was 9 or 10.
Right. And at moments, I think the reader even understands a little bit more than he does.
How challenging was it for you to channel a teenage boy, a growing teenage boy as a narrator?
Well, it felt kind of natural to me, perhaps because I've lived with one for a while. I'm not sure he thought that it was also so pitch perfect. So I had some of my male students read it to sort of get an external vantage. I think it was – I like channeling people for whatever reason who have some kind of interesting new take on vernacular English. But also for me, for this story, I don't know quite else how I didn't – it didn't really start moving until I had that vantage.
Well, and so did the story start with Miles for you?
Well, I wanted to tell a love story, and it's embedded in this story. And I sort of started noodling around with it, but it didn't really start moving and come to life until I hit on Miles's investigation of it.
And it's interesting because, well, I should just ask you, do you you think of it as a love story? Do you also think of it as a mystery or
I
is
do.
It,
yeah. I think of it as sort of both. I mean, a mystery in the sense of, you know, there's no great crime. Some people would say there's a crime, but there's not a prosecutable crime in it. So it's a mystery story applied to the emotional and moral dimensions rather than the criminal.
A mystery in so much as people figuring out the world around them is,
right.
is kind of a continual mystery. I mean, I
right.
think about your adults who are certainly the Mims is a mathematician, and
right.
this speaks to mystery in
Two.
Itself as well.
Yeah.
Was there a central question that you wanted to address as Miles came to you?
I wanted to kind of talk about romantic love and whether it was, I guess you could say, a good idea. And I wanted these kids to be sort of pondering that as they grow up and trying to figure out whether that should have a place in their life or whether there are other more reliable, more accountable kinds of affection that ought to take priority.
I wonder if there's something more organic about kids asking these questions than adults who have already perhaps have their formed opinions about, you know, whether romantic love is worth it or not.
Right. I think there is something to that. And also Miles has a natural sort of suspicion and he and his friend are very suspicious. And yet they're quite innocent really in terms of their own feelings. Like and when something goes wrong, he doesn't have the sort of collection of received assumptions or received ideas of people get over things and, you know, no one dies of love. No, he doesn't have any of those ideas. So he's ready to scream. He's got a kind of raw pain and he'll feel it.
And it's interesting because we think today of teenagers as being a really kind of sexualized bunch. But
not these two.
Yeah, they are both sort of intrigued and also repelled by the idea of sex.
They are, and they're also kind of, I guess you could call them nerds. They're kind of on the outskirts of the mainstream social life of their school. They're not completely out of it, but they're definitely not really mingling in it so much. They occasionally try to, and at moments they get a little close, but they're still in that phase where the most important person really in each other's life is each other. And it's interesting for Miles because he is attracted to girls, and there's one girl in particular he has romantic feelings about, but he realizes that she's not nearly as important to him really as Hector, who he essentially collaborates with about everything, all his major projects in life.
And he and Hector are both from homes where the parents have split up, and it strikes me that neither of them has a particularly good model to work from. Miles's mom is in this furtive relationship with Eli, who, you know, as things play out, is a little mysterious, exactly. And it's certainly not something that he would base a romantic relationship on in watching his mom and Eli, or even thinking
and
back on his mom and dad.
His dad is getting letters under the door from who knows who. although Hector's parents do begin to find other people.
What should we make of the fact that Miles doesn't call his mom mom? He refers to her as the Mims, and he refers to his sisters as the Boops.
He's just got a – he feels he has sort of a little bit of a take on family life. I think he's not quite to the point of calling his mother by her name, but he doesn't want to call her mom. He feels too grown up for that.
Let me ask you just a little bit about Kraft. When you conceived of Miles, did you already in your head know where he was and where he was going?
I didn't exactly know where he was at the end. I knew the age he was, and I knew some of the experiences he'd had. The whole business with college and all and what happens with that, I kind of figured that out as I went along.
And you didn't need to have that planned out before you started?
Well, the way I usually do it is I write a draft and then I revise it many, many, many times. So in a way, that's a kind of – some people outline, some people write a draft. It almost serves the same purpose.
The draft is the outline in this case.
Or I tinker with it there. From there, I make the changes.
I'm curious to have you think back on your time in Green Bay, because you are back in Wisconsin, and – as a writer who deals a lot in setting, I'm curious how you see Wisconsin and your trips. I don't know whether you think of it as home still versus the Green Bay you knew.
You know, I kind of do and I don't. And it's interesting. I was just home in Green Bay mainly to see family and to see two people. One is my mom's very close friend who's 83 and one is a woman who's 95. But actually, I came back to Wisconsin, oh gosh, a little more than a year ago, last spring for a family funeral. And when I was there, it did strike me that I wanted to write more about Green Bay, that I'd written about it a little bit in Anywhere But Here, but I'd written about sort of the Wisconsin, just the limited part of Green Bay that I knew. And it's such an interesting city. I mean, there's so much going on with the between the paper mills and the packing factories and the meat packing factories and the canning factories and the populations who are there to work in them. And yet it's so interesting. I went to a benefit last night at Heritage Hill, which is a sort of beautiful – it's sort of the Green Bay Historical Society. And it's a beautiful place on a hill. But it's less than a mile away from what used to be called, when I was growing up there, the reformatory, and which is now the Wisconsin Correctional Facility. It's a maximum security prison with, you know, armed
guard towers.
Yeah, right. Guard towers with armed sentinels, you know, and all the corners, and maybe even more than just the corners. It's an interesting town that way. And also there's St. Norbert's College, which is a sort of bucolic Catholic college. And right up butting it is a huge sort of 18th century brick paper mill spewing, you know, smoke into the air over the river. It's a fascinating place.
Does Green Bay feel smaller to you than it did when you were growing
up?
No,
it now seems bigger. It has grown quite a bit, actually. It's really incredible. I mean, Alice Munro in some of her work writes about how the country was sort of opened in the early 19th century, the late 1880s. But it's fascinating to see just since I left, I probably left in 1970, just the fields and the farmland that's just been developed and how the stages and it's still going on. I mean, you see new houses with huge piles of excavated dirt.
It's interesting to think of it as larger than when you were growing up there. I mean, I think myself of I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area.
Mm, Green Bay's pretty small for you then.
Green Bay is very small. But
it's a city. It's not. It doesn't feel like a small town. It definitely feels like a city.
Right. It has very much a – I mean, we think of Milwaukee in ways that sometimes it's almost like a miniature Chicago.
Right,
and I wonder
right.
if Green Bay is in a way a miniature Milwaukee.
It's interesting. I think it is a little bit.
But it was definitely a different place.
Definitely a different place.
And that to me, as I make this comparison, Washington and Baltimore in in the 70s and 80s, if you drove to Baltimore, it was like going someplace else.
Whereas now it doesn't feel like that. That's really true, isn't it?
So the world is getting larger and getting smaller
and more
at the
connected.
Same
time. Yeah.
You say you do and you don't think of it as home. Does California feel like home?
It does a little bit, but Green Bay does too. I mean, no one could – certainly I couldn't, but I think almost no one could fully understand California, you know, Southern California. There's so many factors in its history. It's so big. It's got so many huge issues of water and power and all that, language and immigration. I don't yet, but I feel like I maybe could understand Green Bay. You know, I have a lot of intuitions about the place, so – it's a matter of learning what's happened since I left. It has a kind of magic for me.
Well, and do you go back to a place like Green Bay as a writer or – I mean,
As a person. I was thinking that both, certainly both. I think first as a person, but second, you do feel little tingles that seem like, oh, there could be a story here.
And I wonder if you can start connecting the dots of things that you remember and things start to make sense.
Yeah, and just the way people talk and the way people tell a story, there's a lot of sort of deep familiarity. But well, then there's a lot that's new too, so that's exciting.
Well, we will anxiously await what emerges from that.
Thank you.
Mona Simpson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Green Bay native Mona Simpson is the author of such well-known books as Anywhere But Here and Off Keck Road. Her latest novel is Casebook, which came out in April. She stopped by the Lake Effect studio on a recent trip back to Wisconsin to visit family and friends. One last break, and then we'll catch up with the top kora player in the Milwaukee area, some West African music from Yaya Kambaye, when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.